On a cold Saturday night in April of 1982, 18-year-old Lynn Burdick mysteriously vanished while working at a small convenience store less than a mile from her home. Police were notified of her disappearance within 30 minutes, and searches began within the hour. As a winter storm hammered the small town of Florida, Massachusetts, police and volunteers poured over the streets in search of even the slightest clue. For weeks, the searches expanded, covering the entire town, then neighboring towns, and further still. State forests were searched, railroad tunnels, lakes, rivers, and creeks. In the end, the search radius had expanded to within 50 miles of where Lynn had last been seen, but not a trace of her was ever found. While tips had flooded the police for the first weeks, just a few months later, they had all but dried up. For nearly four decades, Lynn's disappearance has haunted not only her family, but also investigators and her hometown. Too much time has passed to continue on without answers, without the truth, and without the ability to bring Lynn home. Where an absence of evidence has always hindered the investigation, there is an abundance of speculation. Was Lynn taken completely at random by someone who kept her alive? Did she fall victim to a yet unknown serial killer who appears to have been stalking through Massachusetts in the 70s, 80s, and 90s? Or is it possible that the answer to Lynn's fate has always been held by someone living in Florida itself? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 189, The Vanishing of Lynn Burdick, Part 2. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we conclude our look into the 1982 disappearance of Lynn Burdick. Before getting back into the case, just a few quick notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. This year, CrimeCon will be taking place in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I'll be there representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend, you can use promo code TRACE to save 10% off your ticket. For more information, visit CrimeCon.com and remember to use promo code TRACE to save 10%. I look forward to seeing you there. For weeks following Lynn's mysterious disappearance, her story was splashed all over the headlines. Search after search covered more and more ground, but it seemed the wider the radius expanded, the further they were from finding any answers. By the summer of 1982, the hope that Lynn would be found quickly was fading. Despite the likelihood of a grim outcome, however, her family refused to give up. This is episode 189, The Vanishing of Lynn Burdick, Part 2. Lynn Burdick was born and raised in the small Massachusetts town of Florida, where she lived in a small wood frame house along Central Shaft Road. In the winter of 1982, Lynn turned 18 and was in her senior year at Charles H. McCann Technical School, where she majored in distributive education. A smart, driven, and inspiring young woman, Lynn achieved high marks at school, volunteered a great deal of her free time to help others, and dedicated much of her life to looking after her mother, who had been diagnosed with both emphysema and asthma. Lynn was the youngest of four siblings, growing up in a blue-collar house where money was often tight and dreams of college would have to wait, but that didn't stop her from giving her all. In April of 82, Lynn was entering her third year working at a local convenience store known as the Barefoot Peddler. Located at the intersection of Route 2, the Mohawk Trail, and Shaft Road, Lynn lived just 6/10 of a mile away, which worked out well, as she often walked or rode her bike. Having turned 18 months earlier, Lynn was now able to work busier weekend closing shifts, which would grant her more hours and more of an opportunity to increase the savings account she was working on. Lynn hoped to accrue enough cash to pick up a dress for her senior prom, an event that she was looking forward to attending as graduation loomed just a few months away. Normally, Lynn didn't work the closing shifts completely alone. Therese Perot, her friend, frequently came by and hung out at the shop until closing time, and on nights where Therese wasn't available, Lynn's boss and the co-owner of the store, Suzanne Burdick, would usually come to keep her company. While there had never been any major issues at the store, Suzanne noted that she felt responsible for Lynn and didn't want to leave her all by herself on weekend nights. On the night of Saturday, April 17th, however, things did not align in a way that would allow it. Therese was out of town at a bowling tournament in Boston, while Suzanne was at home looking after one of her young children, who was sick with the flu. Despite this, Suzanne made several calls to the store to check in on the 18-year-old, and everything seemed to be going well. A winter storm was approaching, and a lot of locals were hitting the store for last-minute supplies, keeping Lynn busier than she normally would have been. At approximately 7:30 p.m., Lynn's older sister, Faye, called to see if she'd need a ride home. According to Faye, while nothing appeared to be obviously wrong, she described Lynn as being short with her. 25 minutes later, Suzanne called around 7:55, and the two chatted for several minutes. During the call, Suzanne heard the bell on the door ring, and Lynn got off the phone quickly, saying she had to help a customer and she'd call right back. She never did. One of the last people reported to have seen Lynn that night was Roy Burdick, a third cousin and the former owner of the Barefoot Peddler. He stopped by with some local teens to pick up supplies for a youth dance. This visit occurred at approximately 8:10 p.m., and from that point on, what exactly happened to Lynn has never been determined. 10 miles to the west, at Williams College, a student narrowly avoided being abducted by an unknown assailant. The man, driving a dark vehicle with rectangular taillights, got the student's attention by asking her for directions. When she approached, he tried to pull her into the car, but luckily, she bit down on his hand hard enough that he let her go. The man sped away from campus around 7:50 p.m. and may have been sighted twice heading east. The last sighting placed the suspect within miles of the Barefoot Peddler, around the same time that calls to the store stopped being answered. At 8:30, Lynn's mother, Dorothy, called to check in on her and see if she needed a ride. There was no answer. Worried, she asked Lynn's older brother, Brian, to stop by the store and see if everything was okay. Upon arriving, Brian found the store abandoned. Lights on, doors unlocked. The only signs of Lynn were a half-drunk soda and an open novel folded face down on the counter. The 18-year-old, her purse, and her jacket were all gone. When police arrived, they quickly discovered that nearly $200 was missing from the register, and they rapidly initiated a massive search for Lynn, who at that point, they worried may have been abducted by the person or persons who had committed the robbery. Unfortunately, a massive storm was settling over town, and search efforts were hindered by rain, hail, strong winds, and several feet of accumulating snow. At first, it was believed that Lynn would be found quickly. How far could her abductor have taken her in that weather? However, as multiple searches throughout the area failed to turn up any trace of the missing teen or the suspect, investigators began to believe that Lynn had to have been taken out of town. Inside of the first weeks, police received more than 300 tips, all of which were tracked, but failed to yield any results. Rivers, state forests, and even abandoned cabins and homes were searched to a point that police stated that every inch of land within a 50-mile radius of Florida had been covered multiple times. On the one hand, they worried Lynn could have been taken anywhere, but on the other, they hadn't found any evidence to suggest she had come to a violent end. For the Burdick family, it was devastating. Their beloved daughter, sister, aunt, and niece was gone. Days of searching became weeks, and weeks became months. The senior prom came and went with no trace of Lynn. Then graduation marked the beginning of summer, and in the space where Lynn should have been sitting, only an empty chair was there with a bouquet of yellow roses. Official searches were called off. The number of tips transformed from a deluge to a drip, and every lead which had been developed was exhausted. Here is where we will pick up the investigation into the disappearance of Lynn Burdick in July of 1982, some 3 months since the 18-year-old mysteriously vanished from the Barefoot Peddler. More than 90 days had come and gone, and the search for Lynn, which had begun within an hour of her disappearance, was slowing down. In an article from the North Adams Transcript, both the Berkshire County District Attorney Anthony Rebello and Florida Police Chief Charles Briggs acknowledged that it had been some time since they'd received any information on what may have happened. Chief Briggs noted to the Transcript that they had started with nothing, no major clues or possibilities, and launching an investigation without any solid evidence had hindered them from day one. That being said, Briggs also commented that while they had found no evidence of what might have become of Lynn, they had also found nothing to make them believe she was dead. Briggs himself was constant in his belief that Lynn was likely alive out there somewhere, perhaps being held against her will, maybe having been manipulated and tricked into joining a religious cult or a commune. Lynn's father, Rufus, spoke to the Springfield Union just a month later in August. Asked about the search for his daughter, he explained that while they couldn't dedicate every waking hour to trying to find her, he and family members continued to search in the evenings and on weekends when they weren't working. Asked about the challenges of not knowing where to go, who could have been responsible, or what may have happened, Rufus replied, quote, "The first week I was running around looking for some clue beside the road, something she could have dropped, and then, later on, you just feel helpless." End quote. The hunt for Lynn had expanded nationally, with posters and flyers describing her and the details of her disappearance being posted at police stations, town halls, and truck stops as far west as Wyoming. Following the trail of any crimes that bore similarities, members of the Massachusetts State Police had traveled to both Florida and Cape Cod, though they never managed to link any other case directly to Lynn's. According to the Berkshire Eagle, random tips still came in from time to time, but they didn't tend to lead anywhere, and there had been several tips which they believe were pranks. Chief Briggs himself noted that his wife had answered several calls on their home phone from people claiming that either Lynn was still alive or suggesting locations where her body might be found, but those callers never gave their names and were never identified. Asked his thoughts, Briggs told the Eagle, quote, "I still say that girl's alive somewhere. It's a hunch, but it's all that keeps us going." End quote. Over the course of the next few months, there was little, if any, information released about the case or any progress on it. October marked 6 months since Lynn had last been seen, but investigators were no closer to finding her or her abductor. The more time passed, the more assumptions about Lynn's fate were turning grim. While Briggs maintained his belief that she was alive somewhere, the state police were leaning more towards a homicide investigation. Caught in the middle were the Burdick family, who, despite struggling to maintain their grip on any hope that they might find Lynn, refused to give in to those darker thoughts, telling the media that no member of the family was the type to give up, and they'd keep searching until they were no longer capable of doing so. The holiday season came around, but the Burdicks found little reason to celebrate. Ultimately, 1982 ended 8 months after Lynn's disappearance, and throughout all that time, little, if anything, had been found. April of 83 marked a full year since Lynn's disappearance, and for the first time in months, investigators announced the launch of a new search. According to the state police, they'd received a tip from an anonymous source who claimed that Lynn's remains could be located in the Hoosick Tunnel, a railroad tunnel that runs for nearly 5 miles beneath Florida Mountain. The state police were joined by both the Florida police and railroad workers out of Boston who searched through the tunnel. According to the tip, Lynn's body would be found approximately 1,500 feet from the entrance, but multiple searches failed to find any trace. Following the conclusion of that search, the state police also informed the Berkshire Eagle that they'd followed up on multiple sightings where people had claimed to have seen Lynn, though none were ever verified. The most recent being reported some 800 miles away in Michigan. Like the others, this too had proven to be a dead end. As for details about the status of the investigation, Corporal Flaherty of the State Police explained to the Springfield Union that they'd run down all leads and failed to find anything that could help them advance the investigation. Asked about any potential suspects, Flaherty noted that they had questioned only half a dozen men who resembled the sketch given out from the Williams College abduction attempt. All of them had been ruled out based on their alibis or other information, and as of that time, a year after Lynn's disappearance, they didn't have any particular suspect or person of interest in mind. Back at the wood-framed home on Central Shaft Road, Dorothy showed the union her collection of newspaper articles about her daughter's disappearance. She hoped to, someday, show the articles to Lynn, restating that both her and the family's determination was that no matter what, they would not be giving up their search. Unfortunately, 1983 would prove to be a year where, other than a few mentions and reminders of the case, no new information about Lynn would be brought to the surface, and by December, some 20 months after her disappearance, Lynn's fate remained as mysterious as it had been that first night. In January of 1984, 3 months prior to what would mark 2 years since Lynn vanished, her parents came forward and issued a public plea. Speaking to the Berkshire Eagle, Dorothy stated, quote, "Whoever has had anything to do with Lynn being missing, to let someone know where she is. And if they've done something to her and buried her, please let someone know where, so we can bring her home and give her a decent Christian burial. People can't just disappear without somebody hearing or knowing something," end quote. Around this same time, the Barefoot Peddler came under new ownership and was opened again. The building itself was remodeled, as during Lynn's time there, it was very closed off and you couldn't see into the store from outside. The new owners installed large windows and moved the door so that it would face the main road rather than the side of the building. In addition to these changes, the name of the store was changed from the Barefoot Peddler to Beer Bellies. Investigators told the Eagle that in the previous year, they'd followed up on more than 100 leads, with the most recent one having come in December of 83. Reportedly, both police and the Burdick family continued to receive calls from alleged psychics who claimed to possess knowledge about the case, but none of those leads ever panned out. While the Florida police continued to investigate Lynn's disappearance as an abduction, the state police were now officially looking at it as a homicide. Asked if they had any evidence to confirm that Lynn had been killed, the state police noted that they didn't, though they didn't wish to comment further on any details of their investigation. Rufus, when being interviewed, acknowledged his own feelings of guilt revolving around advice he'd given to Lynn. He explained, quote, "I had told her if anything ever happened at the store to not put up a fight. I made a mistake in not telling her if they ever came to take her, she should put up a fight," end quote. Heartbroken, Rufus struggled with his belief that his advice could have played a role in Lynn being taken, something that weighed heavy on his heart. During the interview, he also mentioned that the family had become aware of a missing persons locator service offered by the Salvation Army, and they were trying to get that organization to take on Lynn's case. Unfortunately, their request would be turned down. As the Salvation Army explained, their searches were for runaway teenagers, not victims of crimes. 3 months later in April, the solemn 2-year anniversary fell heavy for the Burdick family, as well as Florida, where many residents continued to discuss the case and hoped for a resolution. Dorothy once again made a plea to the public through the Eagle, saying, quote, "If someone knows where Lynn is, let us know. Or if someone is holding her, please let her contact us, because we love her very much and we miss her awful," end quote. Dorothy acknowledged that she agreed with investigators that her daughter had to have been taken, though she couldn't be sure if it had been a crime committed by a random attacker, or if perhaps she could have been taken by some kind of religious cult or possibly an extremist group. Asked about the continued search, Dorothy replied, quote, "I still feel that she's all right someplace. I guess I just don't want to think anything else, or I can't. When I used to go out, I'd be driving around and see someone I thought was her. I'd turn around and go back, but it was just another girl that looked like her. It seems like there's a lot of girls who look like her. You just end up crying," end quote. The state police maintained their view that what had likely begun as an abduction had turned into a homicide. Trooper Robert Scott told the Springfield Union it was their belief that Lynn had probably been killed by her abductor to stop her from being able to identify him. Asked about a failure to find anything, suggesting a murder or any other possibilities, Scott explained, quote, "There's a lot of speculation, but we really believe she's probably dead. She could be in a shallow grave in the woods. It's a very rural area." End quote. As for his perspective, Chief Briggs noted that he continued to believe she was alive, though he stated for the first time his belief that someone in Florida was likely involved, and he believed that person, who may still be living in the area, knew exactly what had happened to Lynn. Unfortunately, while Lynn's case was already growing cold, over the next year, it would become frozen. April of 1985 marked 3 long years and no new information had come to light. By this point in time, Lynn's father had retired. Health issues related to his heart and lungs had caused it, while Dorothy's condition continued to deteriorate, both physically and emotionally. As a result of their health issues, Rufus noted that neither he nor Dorothy got out of the house much, and neither was in a condition to conduct searches through the more rural areas of Florida. As for an update on the case, Corporal Flaherty of the State Police told the Union, quote, "It's just a mystery, but we're really no closer today than we were 3 years ago. We're treating this as a possible homicide. There was no reason for her to disappear like she did. There's always the hope that she's still alive somewhere. We really have no idea what happened. We don't know if she's dead or alive, but there's always a glimmer of hope she's still out there somewhere." End quote. Later that year, in hopes of raising awareness of Lynn's case and in order to honor the missing woman, Charles H. McCann Technical School announced the issuing of an annual scholarship named the Lynn Burdick Memorial Award. Money for the scholarship would be drawn partially from money raised back in 1982 as a reward for information about Lynn's abduction. While this would keep Lynn's name in the public, at least on an annual basis, the investigation into Lynn's disappearance would continue to grow cold, and over the course of the next 2 years, there were no major announcements, no new searches, nothing. It seemed investigators had hit a dead end, and the family were quickly running out of places to search and ways to keep the case alive. On Saturday, February 24th, 1990, Dorothy Burdick passed away after being admitted to the hospital 2 days earlier. She was just 57 years old. Over the previous 8 years since her beloved daughter had gone missing, her condition had only worsened, and she was worn down physically and psychologically. Despite Lynn's fate remaining unknown, she was listed as a surviving daughter in Dorothy's obituary, as she never gave up hope that someday Lynn would come home. She never learned the truth of her daughter's fate, nor did she ever give up hope that someday she would see her again, and hopefully she has. The wood-framed house on Central Shaft Road continued to burn the front spotlight in hope that one day Lynn would find her way. Her upstairs attic room was left untouched, exactly as Lynn had left it the night she vanished. During this time, Rufus noted that they hadn't heard from police or the media for the previous few years, and the family struggled realizing that everyone was seemingly forgetting about Lynn. Trooper Scott, however, told the transcript that they continued to follow up on any tips they received, and they'd consulted the FBI in regard to developing a psychological profile, though he wouldn't give any additional information. Asked if they'd ever managed to develop a link between Lynn's abduction and the Williams College attack, Scott noted they'd never found anything to rule it in or out. 3 years later, on Friday, March 19, 1993, former Florida Police Chief Charles Briggs passed away at the age of 72. Despite leaving the force to retire in 1988 at the age of 68, the one case which haunted him to his final moments was Lynn's. He never gave up hope that someday she'd be found, and to the end he maintained his belief that she was alive. According to his family, his one great regret was that he was never able to break the case or find answers for the family. Briggs had been a major proponent of the Burdick family, and following his retirement, communication between law enforcement and the family had started to fall apart. 2 years later, in 1995, Rufus, now a widower, took a short walk to the mailbox and was shocked by what he found. An anonymous letter postmarked out of Boston claimed to not only have knowledge of what happened to Lynn, but also named a man who was allegedly responsible for her disappearance. Though this individual's identity has never been revealed, it's been reported that the letter not only gave his name, but also listed his location, North Adams, Massachusetts, less than 5 miles west of the former Barefoot Peddler. Rufus, after reading the letter, immediately contacted police, who later acknowledged the letter's existence, but would offer no comment on it. Asked about the letter, Rufus told the Boston Globe, quote, "It could be a crackpot, but this guy, the one mentioned in the letter, he's not a nice person, so it's possible. I've got my eye on this guy," end quote. To date, the writer of the letter has never been identified or come forward with any additional information. While the investigation into Lynn's abduction had hit roadblock after roadblock, and the development of leads had failed to take investigators in any direction that seemingly held answers, there were a series of unsolved crimes through the area, specifically targeting women. From private investigators to authors and journalists, and even some members of law enforcement, a theory began to develop that a serial killer had been active in and around Massachusetts through the 70s and 80s. Whether or not this was an unknown suspect, or perhaps someone who was already confirmed to have been a killer who had failed to be linked to the crimes, remains unknown. It wouldn't be possible to address every unsolved homicide during this period of time in that area, and so we're going to run through a few which either occurred close to Florida or shared similarities to Lynn's abduction. On Friday, November 1st, 1974, 18-year-old Kimberly Benoit was reported missing after she failed to return home from a dance at the Sons of Italy Lodge in North Adams. Just over 2 weeks later, on Saturday, November 16th, Kim's body was discovered at the bottom of a 50-foot embankment 1 mile east of the village of Hoosac Tunnel. The embankment was situated between River Road and the Deerfield River, according to Chief Briggs, approximately 13 miles east of where Kim had last been seen alive. The autopsy ultimately ruled that Benoit had been the victim of a homicide, with her cause of death being both strangulation and blunt force trauma to the head. On Thursday, October 7, 1976, 17-year-old Cynthia Kryzak left her home on Southworth Street at approximately 8 p.m. to walk just over a quarter of a mile to the Sawyer Library on the campus of Williams College. When Cynthia failed to return home, her family contacted authorities, who launched massive search efforts to try and locate the teen. More than 200 people were involved in searches covering more than 15 square miles around Cynthia's home and the college campus, but nothing was found that might suggest what had become of her. More than 3 weeks passed when, on Halloween, Sunday, October 31st, Cynthia's body was discovered by a hunter at the bottom of a 35-foot rocky embankment alongside a creek south of Route 9 in Windsor, Massachusetts. Main Dalton Road travels south from Route 9, following the curves of the Windsor Brook. Cynthia's body had been found at approximately 2 p.m. by David Bowman, a local man and trapper who was setting animal traps in the area. Cynthia's body was found approximately 20 miles southeast of the campus of Williams College, outside of the original search radius, and in a remote location not easily accessible to the average traveler, nor even viewable from the road. An autopsy performed the following day determined that Cynthia had been killed by strangulation, and the coroner's report also noted that, when found, she was fully dressed, but her shoes were missing. 13 miles north of Williams College, across the state line in Bennington, Vermont, a bizarre incident occurred that nearly resulted in the death of a 20-year-old college student. In the early morning hours of Tuesday, November 2, 1976, less than a month after Cynthia's disappearance, Bennington police officer Stephen Brookman spotted a vehicle with its headlights on, but seemingly no one inside, just off Route 67A. Approaching the car, Officer Brookman found Cheryl Mull lying on the floor of the vehicle. She was rushed to the hospital and was able to make a full recovery, though she had a disturbing story to tell. At the time, Cheryl was working at a grocery store, Price Chopper. Working a late shift that night, Cheryl walked out to her car to leave at approximately 12:25 a.m. According to Mull, upon entering her vehicle, an unknown man revealed himself in the back seat, at which time he wrapped battery cables around her neck and began strangling her. Luckily, the assailant noticed Officer Brookman's vehicle turning around to come and check on the car. At that time, the suspect turned off the headlights and fled on foot, escaping before the officer discovered Cheryl unconscious. At the time, rumors were rampant that the attack on Mull was connected to the murders of Cynthia and Kim, but investigators didn't believe there was enough evidence to link them. Due to these unsolved cases, and many others throughout the area where the victims were young women who were abducted and later found dead in rural areas, the media began writing a lot of articles discussing the possibility that a yet unknown serial killer had been at work in the area. Investigators, for their part, mostly noted that while there were similarities in some of the cases, there were enough differences to argue that they likely were not all connected. Of course, out of these investigations came a handful of names thought to possibly be connected to one, several, or all of these unsolved murders. Two of the names most commonly brought up in potential association with Lynn's case, as well as possible involvement in the abduction and murders of Cynthia and Kim, are Lewis Lent Jr. and Leonard Paradiso. Lent, who had previously worked as a janitor in North Adams, was ultimately tried and convicted for the 1990 murder of 12-year-old James Bernardo, who had disappeared from the Pittsfield movie theater where Lent had been employed. Lent later admitted to abducting the 12-year-old by brandishing a hunting knife and forcing him into his vehicle. He then took James back to his apartment where he sexually assaulted the child before killing him. James' body was later found more than 200 miles away in Newfield, New York, not far from Lent's childhood home. 3 years later, in August of 1993, Lent abducted and murdered 12-year-old Sarah Ann Wood of Frankfort, New York, as she was riding her bike home from church. According to his later confession, Lent had been driving his van around looking for a child to assault and kill when he came across Sarah. Again, using a hunting knife, Lent forced Sarah into his van before driving up into the Adirondack Mountains, where he claims to have raped Sarah before violently beating her with a heavy tree branch. He then dug a hole and buried the 12-year-old. When asked if she was still alive at the time of her burial, Lent stated he didn't know for sure, saying, quote, "I didn't check to see if she was breathing because I don't like to touch dead bodies," end quote. Lent later marked on a map the area in which Sarah's body could be found, but multiple searches have failed to discover her remains. More recently, Lent confessed to the murder of 16-year-old Jimmy Lusher, who vanished while riding his bike in Blandford, Massachusetts in November of 92. Outside of the crimes for which Lent had been found guilty or has previously confessed, he's considered a suspect in a number of murders and disappearances going back as far as July of 83. 15 months after Lynn's disappearance. With Lent having lived in North Adams, he surely had a familiarity with the towns surrounding it, including Florida. Lent's victims and potential victims range in age from 9 to 18 years old, include both males and females, and his active years were between 83 and 94. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole in Massachusetts in 1995, and 25 years to life in New York in 1997. Leonard Paradiso is somewhat of a more complicated story. While Paradiso is considered a potential suspect in a number of abductions and murders, he was only ever charged and convicted of one. 20-year-old Marie Iannucci of White Street in East Boston had last been seen alive attending a wedding on Saturday, August 11th, 1979 in Saugus. The next day, on Sunday, August 12th, Marie's body was found by two fishermen behind a vacant lobster store on Lynn Marsh Road in Saugus, where Paradiso had previously worked. Marie's body was clothed when found, though her shoes were missing, and it's ultimately determined that she died of strangulation, likely with the scarf she had been wearing. She had also been sexually assaulted. 5 long years later, in July of 84, Paradiso was tried and found guilty for Marie's murder and assault. He would ultimately be sentenced to life with consecutive sentences for the attempted rapes of two other women. Investigators began working on determining whether or not Paradiso may have been involved in the murders and disappearances of other women in the area, and while a number of names have come to the surface, whether or not Paradiso was involved has never fully been determined. The prosecutor who convicted Paradiso is a man named Timothy Burke. and he went on to write a book entitled The Paradiso Files, Boston's Unknown Serial Killer. In this book, he attempts to link Paradiso to 7 unsolved murders and disappearances, most notably those of Cynthia Kryzak and Kimberly Benoit. The book was released just weeks before Paradiso died in jail in February of 2008. Through his work on Paradiso, Burke was able to find several pieces of evidence which connected him to the area of Florida, where he frequently went on hunting trips with friends, though Paradiso almost always drove by himself. Research during Paradiso's trial and after was able to establish that he had knowledge of Florida and its surrounding areas, that he knew the backwoods areas extremely well, and that as a hunter, he would have been aware of isolated spots where bodies could be easily concealed. Photographs found in Paradiso's apartment showed him in hunting gear in and around Florida from 1967 to 1974. I think it's worth noting that many of the missing women, whose remains were later recovered, were found by other hunters in the area. Burke would ultimately argue that he could prove Paradiso had been in Florida just days prior to the disappearance of Kim Benoit. One of the previously mentioned photos shows Paradiso outside of the Summit Motel in November of 74. Benoit's body was found within 3 miles of that motel later that month. In regard to Lynn's disappearance, Burke has evidence that Paradiso had a meeting with his parole officer on Thursday, April 15th, 1982, 2 days before her abduction. On April 22nd, 5 days after Lynn vanished, a 1979 Oldsmobile Cutlass driven by Paradiso was reported missing from his girlfriend's house. This vehicle was later found submerged in Boston Harbor, as Paradiso had a habit of eliminating vehicles through either torching or sinking, in an attempt to both eliminate evidence and collect on insurance payouts. Burke explained to the Eagle, quote, "I have no evidence linking him to these crimes, but I know his mindset. If you follow his pattern, Lim becomes another potential victim. I wanted the Burdicks to be aware of the information I have," end quote. For their part, many of the Burdick family didn't agree with the theory that Paradiso had been involved. Roy, the cousin who had last seen Lynn at the store moments before her disappearance, told the Eagle, quote, "I think it's wrong to create a scenario for these people who lost Lynn all these years ago. Now they have to sit there and think, did this happen to my daughter?" End quote. Sue Olison, another cousin of Lynn's, felt similarly, noting that this new information provided no closure, saying, quote, "There are a host of possibilities out there more solid than this one." End quote. For his part, Rufus tried to be accepting of the possibility, saying any new information could be helpful. Both police and the Berkshire County District's Attorney's Office walked a neutral line, saying that while Paradiso was a possibility, there was no solid evidence established to connect him to Lynn, Cynthia, or Kim. While the possibility of a serial killer being responsible for Lynn's abduction is a theory which has been considered off and on over the years, no evidence has ever been found which can make any direct connections. Lynn herself has never been located, and as such, it becomes a situation where any number of possibilities can be considered, though not proven. Unfortunately, as so much of this case has been, a dramatic absence of any real evidence has always been at the heart of this mystery, and without something more substantial, the hope of finding the truth remains obscured. 4 years after the publication of Burke's book, on Tuesday, June 12th, 2012, Rufus Burdick passed away at the age of 84. Much like Dorothy, Rufus went to his grave never knowing what had become of his beloved daughter and hoping against all odds that the answers would be found before his life came to an end. Sadly, those answers were never found, and Rufus had to endure the daily pain of her loss. At the time of his death, Lynn had been missing for 30 years and 2 months. In one of his last interviews, Rufus expressed his continued hope to someday see his daughter again, telling the North Adams Transcript, quote, "The yard light is still on for her. When she would come home, she'd usually come up and over the lawn, so that's still on. It will always be on. I'd like to know what happened, and hopefully she's still alive somehow, somewhere out there," end quote. For the most part, Lynn's story once again disappeared from the headlines following her father's death. The occasional mention came here and there, when other unsolved cases from the region were discussed. Her name and image appeared several times in articles about all of the women who had disappeared or been murdered in and around the Berkshires. But in regard to advances in the case or any new information, there was nothing. While the search for Lynn was carried on by her parents until their deaths, just last year, new articles began circulating, discussing the passing of the torch, so to speak, as younger members of the Burdick family took up the charge of finally finding the answers to Lynn's fate. Debbie Devine was just 1 year old when her Aunt Lynn went missing. As the 40th anniversary of her disappearance will occur this coming April, Debbie's decided to pick up where her grandparents left off. In an interview with The Eagle, Debbie explained that she grew up surrounded by memories of Lynn, noting that there were candlelight vigils, gatherings, and the burial of time capsules. In April of 2021, Debbie launched a GoFundMe to raise money so that Lynn's image and details of her disappearance could be placed on billboards along Curran Highway in North Adams. Debbie, in an effort to raise awareness and to hopefully garner new information, also launched an official Facebook page entitled Finding Lynn Burdick. The page is filled with information about the case, photographs, newspaper articles, theories, and almost everything you could possibly want to know. On the GoFundMe, Debbie wrote that her family doesn't just want, but needs closure. For decades, there's been a belief that someone living in Florida or the surrounding area knew what had become of Lynn, and for nearly 40 years, they've kept their mouth shut. Hopefully, with so much time having passed, maybe someone will now be willing to come forward and tell what they know, to finally end this mystery which has haunted a family and a town for nearly half a century. The most recent update occurred last month in February when a collaboration between the State Police Unresolved Case Unit, the State Department of Corrections, and multiple district attorney's offices throughout Massachusetts announced a deck of playing cards featuring images of victims of unsolved homicides and disappearances. In a video announcing the launch of these decks, Christopher Mason of the State Police explained, quote, "You may remember hearing some of these cases. Others will be new to you. But know this, for each and every one, there's someone who lives with a hole in their heart or their home, which was once filled by one of these victims." End quote. Lynn was added to the deck, with her image and details of her disappearance adorning the King of Diamonds. It's hoped that these cards will bring in new tips and information that might finally solve some of these cases, including Lynn's. When last seen, Lynn Marie Burdick was described as being a white female with shoulder-length brown hair and blue eyes, standing 5 feet 4 inches tall and weighing 115 pounds. Lynn was last seen wearing jeans, a gray, blue, and yellow striped shirt, and white sneakers with blue stripes. Her school jacket from Charles H. McCann Technical disappeared with her, along with her class ring holding a blue stone. The ring may be engraved with one of her initials or her full name. At the time, Lynn wore large-framed glasses, which also went missing with her, along with her purse. Lynn was last seen working at the former location of the Barefoot Peddler at the intersection of Massachusetts Route 2, the Mohawk Trail, and Shaft Road. It's believed that she was abducted during the course of a robbery, which was likely to have occurred between 8:10 and 8:50 p.m. Lynn was 18 years old and a high school senior, and no trace of her has ever been found. If alive today, she would have turned 58 last month. Though it's never been confirmed whether or not Lynn's abduction is connected to the attempted kidnapping at Williams College less than 30 minutes before her disappearance, the suspect in that case is often included in Lynn's case summary. That suspect has been described as being a white male in his mid-30s, standing 5 feet 10 inches tall and carrying a pot belly. The man had ear-length brown hair parted to one side, was clean-shaven, and was not wearing glasses. On the night of the attack, he was wearing a dark jacket, possibly a windbreaker, and was driving a late-model car, dark in color, with light blue interior, bucket seats, a floor console, and rectangular taillights. A composite of the suspect is available, and investigators noted a caller notified them of seeing a similar vehicle speeding along Route 2 in the direction of the Barefoot Peddler just minutes before Lynn disappeared. 1 month from now, the calendar will flip over to April 2022. Sunday, April 17th, will mark 40 years since Lynn mysteriously vanished. For four decades, countless police officers, family members, volunteers, friends, and even strangers have struggled to find the answers, to discover what happened to the intelligent, kind, compassionate, and dedicated young woman who devoted so much of her life to helping others. Perhaps enough time has passed, perhaps the answers are closer than they've ever been. Asked about her aunt's case, Debbie Devine explained to the Eagle, quote, "My grandpa and grandma passed, and they didn't know what happened. Somebody out there knows something. Maybe they'll decide it's time to say something." This episode is sponsored by Surfshark. Have you ever noticed that it seems like the internet is getting more dangerous by the second? Well, that's because it is. Hackers have more ways to target you. Trackers are following your every move, and malware is hiding all over the web. Luckily, there's a solution. You can get a VPN. A VPN will hide your real location, making you more difficult to identify and target, but privacy and security are not all that Surfshark has to offer. If you use a VPN, you can forget about geo restrictions. You ever watch a video and get confronted by a message that it isn't available in your area? Well, with Surfshark, you'll be able to access everything, from news sources to social media apps that are unavailable to you because of your location. Just change your virtual location and access all the entertainment you want safely and securely. So try Surfshark risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/trace. Enter promo code TRACE for 83% off and 3 extra months free. That's surfshark.deals/trace. Use promo code TRACE for 83% off and 3 extra months free. Surfshark.deals/trace, promo code TRACE. I think we've all seen commercials and visited sites that offer DNA tests to unlock the mysteries of our pasts. While that's always a fun and interesting thing to do, it's not uncommon to receive surface-level results leaving you wanting more answers, and that's where GenomeLink comes in. GenomeLink aims to help people get the most value out of their genetic results. GenomeLink doesn't perform DNA tests. Instead, they use those test results to provide more in-depth information based on that person's genetics. GenomeLink has a team of dedicated researchers who have curated over 10,000 genetic studies to build a database and algorithm for accurate DNA genetic testing. In layman's terms, they're working hard to stay ahead of the curve with the most recent developments in the genomics field and to help you connect with the most recent and relevant genetic research. Don't just settle for your basic DNA analysis. Upload your DNA test results from anywhere like Ancestry, 23andMe, or MyHeritage and find out what makes you, well, you. We all know that DNA testing has helped solve many unsolved crimes. GenomeLink can provide you with in-depth information about yourself and your ancestry. GenomeLink analyzes your raw DNA data and gives you access to many more results and information that isn't provided by companies when you get your original DNA test. Personal trait reports provide you with personalized advice for fitness, nutrition, mental well-being, and even skincare. GenomeLink is set up in accordance with the requirements of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA, the federal level security standards for safeguarding protected health information, so your information is safe and secure. Discover your full genetic potential by uploading your existing DNA test results at genomelink.io. Get access to over 25 free trait reports and receive your results instantly. No trial period, no credit card, and no hidden fees. Go to genomelink.io. Sign up today and discover your full genetic potential. Massachusetts Route 2, the Mohawk Trail, has been described as one of the most famous scenic driving routes in the Berkshires, following the old trail Native Americans of the Five Nations used to pass between Connecticut and Hudson Valleys. The high point of the trail takes you to Whitcomb Summit, an elevation of 2,173 feet, granting scenic views into southern Vermont and New Hampshire. From this spot, one can continue along to Charlemont or turn right heading south towards the Savoy State Forest. 2 miles west of the summit, the Mohawk Trail intersects with Central Shaft Road, with the trail continuing on to the northeast while Central Shaft turns sharply south. Today, there's nothing much to see at the intersection. A sign directing traffic towards the forest, the overgrowth of the backwoods, and on the southeast corner, the remnants of what was once the Barefoot Peddler. A thin patch of green grass and the worn shadow of a parking area linger where years earlier, the main structure was torn down. While the building itself has long since faded, the memories of that Saturday night in April of 1982 remain as powerful and haunting as they were nearly 40 years ago. Driving past the empty field south on Central Shaft Road, you can still go past the old wood-framed home where Lynn Burdick once lived. While her parents, Dorothy and Rufus, have since passed away, the structure is still home to her relatives, who have never forgotten the 18-year-old, nor the continued search for her. 40 years. Take a moment to think about how much time that is. While maybe not the best reference for the listening audience, I can't help but mention that Lynn disappeared 7 months before I was born. For every year of my life, the mystery of her disappearance has endured, and while for me, 40 years seems like a long time, I can't begin to imagine what it must be like for those who loved her, searched for her, hoped for her return, and ultimately lost their lives without ever knowing the truth. Since we don't really have any solid theories to work with in regard to Lynn's disappearance, I don't really want to go down the rabbit hole of too many possibilities, as has been noted throughout the episode, there's a lot of different possibilities. I think we all know whatever happened to Lynn wasn't by her own choice, and once you close that door, the only options are fairly basic. She was abducted by someone she'd never met before, or she was the victim of someone she may have known, or who perhaps knew her. So I think we'll start by taking a look at the area in which she disappeared from, and then move into different possibilities about her assailant. A quick examination of Florida gives you one overarching notion: the vastness of the mountains, forests, rivers, creeks, and backwoods trails. The search for Lynn required maneuvering through treacherous terrain, steep embankments, forests too thick to see from, and rivers and ponds whose flowing waters might be impossible to completely search. Factor in the weather that night: snow falling several feet at a time, heavy rains, and hammering hail. While there's no way of knowing for certain, it seems likely that Chief Briggs may have been right when he theorized that Lynn had to have been taken out of the area. What are the chances someone wouldn't have seen the tire marks leading into the forest or heading up the mountain? How likely is it that the abductor would have wanted to stick around, waiting for the weather to possibly trap him in the middle of a massive manhunt? So where would he have gone? South into greater Massachusetts, maybe someplace like Pittsfield, Northampton, or Springfield. Perhaps he'd want to get out of the state altogether, turn west and cross the line into New York, maybe to Berlin State Park, Taconic Lake, or even someplace near to Albany. He also could have traveled north, crossing the state line into southern Vermont, where within a few hours he could have gone to Bennington, Searsburg, or Green Mountain National Forest. If he kept heading east along the Mohawk Trail, he'd have a lot of options: south towards Greenfield, north along I-91 into Vermont, or maybe travel a little further, dip into southern New Hampshire. Searches for Lynn ultimately expanded to cover areas within a 50-mile radius of the Barefoot Peddler, and that would have covered all of the areas I just mentioned, and more. While I'm certain the searches were dedicated and focused, it's simply not possible that all of those areas could have been covered in just a few months. Main roads, yeah. Well-traveled paths, definitely. But all you have to do is glance at a map to see how absolutely overwhelming searching that massive amount of land must have been. That's what everyone was faced with: a storm settling over town, a vast landscape through the mountains, and not a single clue of which direction to go. I can't begin to imagine how overwhelming it must have felt, how overwhelming it must always feel, when someone you love is gone and you don't even know where to begin. No way of knowing if Lynn was taken hundreds of miles away or was dumped somewhere within just a few miles, maybe into the wilderness. There's obviously a great deal of information in this case that's unknown, so let's turn our attention to what we do know, which shouldn't take too long to examine. Saturday, April 17th, 1982, 18-year-old Lynn Burdick is working behind the counter of the Barefoot Peddler. Being one of the only places to quickly grab basic supplies without needing to head out of town, the store was busy as the storm loomed. Lynn arrived for work around 4 p.m. and was set to get off 5 hours later at 9. We know Lynn was in the store and accounted for until approximately 10 after 8. The first unanswered call comes in 20 minutes later around 8:30. 10 minutes after that, Lynn's brother is on the scene and the police are notified that the high school senior has vanished, the store has been robbed of nearly $200, there's no sign of a struggle, and the only things missing beside the money are Lynn, her purse, and her jacket. No one knows exactly when Lynn was taken, but narrowing that window down to within 8:10 and 8:40 means that the 18-year-old was robbed and abducted in a window of 30 minutes or less. Now, were she taken closer to 8:40, her abductor wouldn't have had as much of a head start, but were it closer to 10 after, then he would have been on the road for at least 30 minutes before anyone even began searching. Given the weather and the curves of the roads in that area, even with the 30-minute head start, the abductor couldn't have gotten more than 20 or so miles away. Not knowing what direction he may have gone raises a lot of questions. How far would he be willing to drive along roads that were growing more treacherous with each drop of snow, while also holding a woman against her will? The problem, again, is we just have no way of knowing. We don't have a direction to go, we don't have an area to focus in on. All we've got are a lot of assumptions, educated guesses, and hope. So we follow the path of investigators. Lynn running off by her own choice was ruled out within the first 20 minutes of the search. So all you're left with is that she was abducted. The store was robbed that night, but I can't help but wonder, was the robbery the original plan, and Lynn was taken in order to protect the assailant's identity, or was this always going to be an abduction? I suppose if indeed the suspect in this case is the same one who tried to abduct the student from Williams College, that maybe having failed once that night and needing to feed his grotesque desires, he would have turned to the next viable option. Knowing the answer to this question would be helpful because I can't help wondering, did he know the Barefoot Peddler was there and proceeded on in hopes of taking someone else? Or did he simply head off in that direction and when he saw Lynn working there alone, decided to leap at that opportunity? Then, of course, there's another possibility. If you're looking for someone who was not only familiar with the area but local to it, he could have known Lynn would be working that night. Even if he didn't, he might have recognized her and perhaps she recognized him. What would the abductor be more concerned about? A woman giving a basic description of him to police following the robbery, or someone who could actually identify him to investigators who surely would have been following up on that armed crime? While the latter seems more logical, we all know that in cases like these, logic doesn't apply. If you're dealing with someone sick and twisted enough to do something like this, then you really never know what they're capable of. When it comes down to specific people, we don't really have any. There never was much talk about people Lynn may have known or who may have known her who were questioned or considered possibilities. I'm sure that more than 6 people were questioned over the years, but it doesn't seem like they ever really found anything to even go so far as naming someone as a person of interest or even saying that they had one. If we look at the two names I mentioned during the evidence section, Lewis Lent and Leonard Paradiso, there are both pros and cons to the possibility of either being involved. Beginning with Paradiso, Lynn physically fit the types of women he tended towards attacking, and we know he'd been to Florida, was familiar with the area, and lived in Massachusetts at the time, though he was approximately 2.5 hours away in Revere. Now, that doesn't mean he couldn't have been in the Florida area that night. Even with him having met with his parole officer 2 days before, that's plenty of time to make the trip. Paradiso tended to target hitchhikers, or women out in areas by themselves where no one else was around, and he could convince them to get into his car. We know in at least one instance he targeted a sex worker, again, someone who wouldn't have had a hard time being convinced to get in. Now, this might actually match up with the attempted abduction at Williams College. He asks for directions to lure the victim closer and then tries to pull her in the car. This time, however, she fights back hard enough to escape, and he gets out of there as fast as he can. At this point, the question becomes, does he head east in hopes that he's going to find someone else along the way to abduct? Is he merely trying to get away, or is he intentionally heading towards the store? Maybe he wanted to get some alcohol or cigarettes. Maybe another abduction attempt wasn't even on his mind until he found Lynn there by herself and vulnerable to his predatory nature. Now, according to Burke's book, Paradiso did possess a .38 caliber handgun, which he used to threaten and control victims. He surely could have pulled the gun out to convince Lynn to leave the store and get into his car. On the other hand, in at least some instances, Paradiso is alleged to have feigned an injury to draw an unsuspecting victim closer. On the night Lynn vanished, it's been mentioned that she helped a customer on crutches by carrying his bags out for him. Could he have come back? Outside of this information, what we know about Paradiso in 1982 is limited. He does fit the description of the Williams College abductor to some degree. He was heavyset, often described as pot-bellied, and had dark hair. Sometimes he had facial hair, sometimes he didn't. Unfortunately, I couldn't find out his height. It seems it's never mentioned anywhere, but in 82, he would have been in his late 30s, within range of the description given by the woman who had escaped. Now, Paradiso's a consideration, but it's worth noting that there's never been any solid evidence. No one can confirm him being in Florida that night. Any questions he may have been asked about Lynn have never been revealed, which seems to suggest he didn't provide any answers. And while he's bounced around as a potential suspect in other murders in the area, almost all of his victims tended to be in the Boston area. I think it's also worth noting that I've yet to come across a single member of Lynn's family who believed Paradiso was involved. For the most part, it seems they believe the potential links between he and Lynn, let alone any other victims in the area, are loose at best. Law enforcement, for their part, gave the generally dismissive comments you often see from police when they don't want to talk about something. Sure, it's a possibility, but there are plenty of those. If we move on from Paradiso and look towards Lewis Lent, there's a little more to hold on to. Lent lived in North Adams, just 14 miles west of Florida and in the area of Williams College. While Paradiso was only ever convicted of one murder, Lent confessed to three and was considered a suspect in many more. His approach is more varied. While Paradiso tended to have a type and targeted lone women in vulnerable situations, Lent went after children, teenagers, and occasionally people who were legally adults. His crimes revolved around sexual assault and murder, and while two bodies were found, at least one of his confirmed victims, Sarah Ann Wood, has never been located. Lent was prepared. He kept a kit with him where he held tape for his victims' wrists and ankles, and he had a large hunting knife that he brandished to abduct them and keep them under control. Aside from living in North Adams, we know he grew up in upstate New York and was familiar with both urban and rural areas along the more than 200-mile stretch from Massachusetts across the state line. While Paradiso tried to lure victims, Lent was more aggressive. When he saw an opportunity, he took it, and he didn't appear to hesitate to pull out his knife and drag someone into his van. So it isn't exactly difficult to imagine he could have gone into the store that night, felt the urge to do something terrible, and when he saw Lynn by herself, pulled out the knife and forced her out. I think it goes without saying, but when it comes to either Paradiso or Lent, once you were in their vehicle, your chances of survival were limited at best. For Lent, he could have gone west towards New York. He knew the area, he had a lot of isolated spots around there, and he's already shown that in some cases he knows how to conceal a body so that it's never found. I guess the question would be whether or not he was hunting that night, in which case he'd have supplies to take care of the job, or if Lynn might have been more of a spur-of-the-moment decision. At the same time, we know in at least one case, Lent brought his victim back to his own apartment, where he kept him until disposing of his body the next day. That certainly could have happened in Lynn's case as well. Knowing that they were searching for her, he could have kept her in North Adams for any amount of time, or he might have taken her elsewhere altogether. That's the key frustration of this case. Again, almost anything is possible. While I don't want to go into a lot of detail about it, there's another name that's come up from time to time. This name links to a man in North Adams as well, although this man was never arrested and tried for murder, at least as far as I can tell. Being that he's never been publicly named, I don't really want to use his full name here, so I'll just refer to him as R.R., and I assume people familiar with this case will know who I'm talking about. Finding any solid information about R.R. has been challenging, to say the least, but he's certainly someone that others believe could have been involved. He lived in the area, had a bad reputation, and as a North Adams man, he may have frequented or occasionally stopped by the Barefoot Peddler. Unfortunately, we don't know enough about him to link him to anything even remotely related to Lynn's disappearance, but I've often wondered if perhaps he could have been the North Adams man named in the letter Rufus received. On the other hand, that name could easily have been Lewis Lent, As Rufus noted, the man was very bad, and by the time he got that letter in 1995, Lent was already being investigated. I wish I had more to work with, and I wish investigators did. Unfortunately, we hit the same roadblocks they did more than 40 years ago. No solid suspects, no idea what direction the abductor could have gone, no knowledge of whether the crime was premeditated or spur of the moment, no certainty if Lynn was targeted or selected randomly. When you have so little, it's hard to put much of a story together, unless, of course, someone with information decides to share it. I tend to agree with Chief Briggs. There's a good chance someone living in Florida at the time knows a hell of a lot more about this than they've ever chosen to share. Hopefully, sometime soon, things will change now with Debbie Devine continuing the fight to find justice for her aunt. Lynn Burdick mysteriously vanished from behind the counter of the Barefoot Peddler between 8:10 and 8:40 p.m. on the night of Saturday, April 17th, 1982. For nearly 40 years, her fate has remained a mystery which has haunted both her parents to their graves. Whether it was a random act, a cold and calculated plot, the whim of a psychopath, or a situation of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, Lynn deserves justice, and her family deserves closure. Unfortunately, unless new evidence is found, Lynn is discovered, or someone finally comes forward, the vanishing of Lynn Burdick will remain open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the vanishing of Lynn Burdick, the Berkshire Eagle, North Adams Transcript, and Springfield Union have the most extensive coverage. You can also visit the Facebook page Finding Lynn Burdick, which is run by family members and provides a wealth of information. Lynn is listed on NamUs, and her case number is MP25680. If you have any information about the vanishing of Lynn Burdick, please contact the Massachusetts State Police at 413-743-4700. Lynn Burdick is case number 821-031-006-39. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod. Message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Just a quick reminder that I'll be attending CrimeCon in Las Vegas representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. To save 10% off your pass, use promo code TRACE at CrimeCon.com. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers. Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Donna Buttram, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Eloanne Meyer, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Haley Christie, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Jill Sense, Joni Berkowitz, Julie Mangano, Kara Moreland, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Marla Wright, Melissa Brekeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stacy Finnegan, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Adorable Susie Summers, Taylor, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That concludes our two-part look into the vanishing of Lynn Burdick. I want to thank you all again for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.